Good afternoon. It's 12:07. I'm Sean Beter, and this is Midday Matters Health 360 on WBOI Fort Wayne. I'm Sean Beter, and with me, Dr. Robert Barnes, pediatrician at the St. Joe Medical Group. Dr. Barnes, welcome back to Midday Matters Health 360.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
We're talking, as you heard in the billboard today, about pediatric vaccinations and immunizations. We'd love to hear from you if you have a question or comment. We know vaccinations have been a hot topic in recent years, so we'd love to hear from you this hour. Call us at 800-471-9264. You can always email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. Lots of ways to get in touch with us today, and we certainly hope you will. Dr. Barnes, let's start with the basics on vaccinations and just tell us how they work. I think a lot of folks think, you know, I get this vaccination when I'm a young child or when I'm a teenager, and I'm done with that that ailment for the rest of my life. Take us back to basics here on that.
Well, we've learned a lot. I've been a pediatrician over 30 years, so I've seen some of the issues before and after the controversies that started in the 80s with a really strong anti-vaccine lobby. Vaccines generally simply induce a person's immune system to develop antibodies to something in that vaccine, whether it's a killed one or a live vaccine, with hopefully minimal side effects, but yet will protect in the vast majority of cases against the clinical illness itself. In some cases, having that natural illness, say chickenpox, is still a little better than having even two vaccines for it. That's natural immunity. But obviously, if we can avoid suffering and disability with vaccines, we would like to do that. And hopefully we can keep the side effects to a minimum. The side effects, I think, have become a stronger issue in a lot of parents' minds or grandparents' minds than the benefits, the millions of lives that have been saved since the vaccine era really began.
Tell us a little bit about, you mentioned there are live vaccines and killed vaccines. Tell us a little bit about the difference.
There have been different live vaccines over the years. The only one we really have now, the flu vaccine, the nasal vaccine, can be given to patients 2 years and up. That's a live vaccine. Also, measles, mumps, and rubella, and chickenpox officially are live vaccines. At one point, we had a polio vaccine that was live, and it did work well. But because of the possibility that because it was given oral, the virus could be excreted in the stools for a baby. If mom, grandmother, if a caretaker changing those diapers might have been on chemotherapy or might have had an immune issue himself or herself, it was considered to be too dangerous. And so that one was taken away from us quite a few years ago, and we're back to a killed vaccine again. The live ones, I think people worry about a little bit more, but in the cases of MMR and Varivax, the chickenpox shot, those are the only choices we have. Flu, we have the choice of the killed vaccine, which can be given to babies as young as 6 months of age, or the live one can be given to two-year-olds. We cannot give the live vaccine to patients who have a history of asthma. That's a very large group, and it seems to be getting bigger. But obviously, the older kids who can get the nasal vaccine are very happy to avoid the pain and suffering that they think they're going to experience.
Sure, and you bring up a good point here. As we talk about vaccines, it's not always a shot in the arm, so to speak.
It's not always a shot in the arm. We wish we had more oral vaccines. We have a very good one right now that prevents a winter diarrhea in babies called rotavirus. It seems to be very effective, but there are not a lot of oral vaccines. And this is a time of year when a lot of kids are getting ready for school in the fall, and so we're giving multiple vaccines to a lot of families. So it is a very hot topic.
When we're talking about let's go back to the beginning. How soon do children really need to start on the standard vaccination schedule?
Newborns in the hospital are offered the hepatitis B vaccine. It's a killed vaccine. Parents will sign yes or no. We want it while the baby's still hospitalized in the newborn nursery. Otherwise, normally the schedule begins at 2, 4, and 6 months with multiple ones, including diphtheria, whooping cough, tetanus, polio, hepatitis B, H influenza, which prevents meningitis, and also that rotavirus vaccine that's oral. So that's the typical schedule for the American Academy of Pediatrics, 2, 4, and 6 months. The other vaccines usually start at a year of age, and that would include hepatitis A in the news recently in Fort Wayne, also chickenpox and the measles, mumps, and three-day measles shot. Those start at a year of age. We're also hearing that, I believe in the next school year, 2014, that kindergartners in Indiana will be required to get hepatitis A vaccine started. That has been available for one-year-olds, a killed vaccine, for a long time. I believe this will be the first time that's absolutely required. I don't know then if they'll require catching up older children who haven't received it in the past, but we think in a year from now it will be required for school entry. Parents who refuse it probably would have to sign a waiver.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because there are, I mean, as you mentioned, a number of vaccinations that are required before children enter grade school or maybe enter high school or even college.
Right.
Why?
Well, I think we're just simply trying to prevent the spread of these possible infections in a group that spends a lot of time together.
Confined spaces being very
in
good
school,
for,
yes, and it happens for, again in 18 to 22 year olds, either going off to college in dormitory situations or military recruits living in barracks. They're all in quote close quarters. For example, we don't have a vaccine against it, but we tend to see an awful lot of strep throats during the school year. It's amazing when kids are out in the summer, the numbers usually drop immediately. As soon as school starts, we start seeing them again, and a lot of these things are passed very easily. And small kids aren't the most terrific at coughing into their sleeve or a handkerchief, or you know, it just isn't something that's a priority for a five-year-old to worry about what kind of viral load he's spreading by coughing or sneezing.
When we talk about vaccines, and of course we are inviting questions from our listeners today, you can always call us at 800-471-9264. Email us middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. What are some of the concerns that you've seen from parents in the last few years, or even the last few decades, I guess, about getting their kids started so early or getting their kids vaccinated at all?
Well, there's issues about individual vaccines, and there's an awful lot of issues more recently about maybe we're giving too many vaccines at one time. Maybe the body's immune system can't handle this number of antigens. Antigens are just the ingredients in the vaccine that produce antibodies against those antigens in the human body. The national expert for us seems to be Dr. Paul Offit. If anybody wants to look him up, O-F-F-I-T, at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And he believes that even a visit, say the two-month-old visit or the five-year-old visit where multiple vaccines are normally given, that's our recommended schedule anyway, he thinks that we're giving hundreds of antigens to a person who could normally handle millions of antigens. But I have to say, I do have family still who do worry about the number of them and decide to space them out. I don't really have an issue with it. Sometimes it becomes a little more expensive for the patient if there's a copay every time and there's multiple visits. I can't control how the insurance company deals with that sort of thing. And if that is the case, and I'm finding it's a popular notion that we're giving too many at one time and overwhelming the immune system, that the families feel we're going to have more side effects and dire side effects. If that happens, I will tell parents what I think the most important ones are. And this time of year, with children outside running around barefoot, even though we don't recommend that, tetanus is certainly a big one. There's a thing called herd immunity. If your whole neighborhood and your whole family's immunized, say, against measles, your child is less likely to get it. Tetanus is different. Tetanus happens, of course, from a dirty wound. We always hear about stepping on a rusty nail. And if the Clostridium tetani gets going in your body, whether the kid next door is immunized against tetanus or not doesn't make any difference. I saw it once. I saw a full-blown case of tetanus once when I was an intern in 1975, and I hope I never see it again. The child survived, but it was really horrible. And it was a case where it was a large family, lived on a farm. I think they just lost track. This kid seemed to have escaped. The family doctor thought, yes, I'm sure all those children got their vaccines. But when they looked back in the records, they found out he hadn't received any, and he stepped on a dirty pitchfork in the barn. He came into Riley Hospital one night with lockjaw, unable to move his mouth very well. And they were assured, I think, before the era of electronic medical records where we could look it up on a state website, they were assured, oh, I'm sure he had his tetanus vaccines. Next morning, he stopped breathing, went on a ventilator, and then it was obvious that what was wrong. But that one is really scary in summertime. So this time of year, the children who are not fully immunized, I think that's a priority. And it brings up another issue in that the tetanus vaccine really is only available with diphtheria hooked with it, and it also can come with pertussis or whooping cough. A plain tetanus toxoid vaccine, the old one that adults used to receive as boosters, is not appropriate to begin the series with. Hmm. So that's also a problem in that, okay, if you'll agree to do tetanus, we also have to get you agree to give your child at least one other vaccine or another, because I can't give simply tetanus and assure that your child is adequately protected.
Even so, I mean, do you think that the concerns, given what you've said here against children's immune systems not being able to handle, say, a half dozen immunizations, are unfounded?
The medical research really doesn't support it. I always tell parents, you can find a lot of very scary information on the internet, but like everything we read on the internet, we should be discerning about who's writing it. Are they qualified? And there's lots of anecdotal stories about Jenny McCarthy was in the public eye long a few years ago now about she was sure that MMR had a lot to do with her son's diagnosis of autism. Medically, it's been disproven, but it's hard to, in one anecdotal case, it's difficult for parents to see through that. Typically, when they're finding warnings like that on the internet, they're not finding stuff from Dr. Offit or from Harvard or from Stanford or, you know, renowned institutions that do a lot of research. It could be an anecdotal story from one family. And I just tell patients, you just have to be a little bit discerning, you have to be a little bit suspicious and try to read through it. And emotionally, these heartbreaking side effects, whether they're caused by vaccines or not, are very upsetting. I understand that. But the medical evidence tends to show that the vast majority of these vaccines are safe. And the FDA has to see a lot of testing on children before they will approve the distribution of these vaccines. There have been changes over the years in some of them. I'm not saying that they've never, ever made a mistake, but the really inflammatory anecdotal stories, sometimes you have to read through them to make sure that the complaints against the vaccine are valid.
You're saying one case doesn't make a trend, even two.
Well, the FDA certainly wouldn't accept that, right? They see thousands of vaccine doses, looking at side effects, and even the research is ongoing afterwards. I mean, if there's a vaccine injury in this country, we have a form or the internet, we can put in we can send something right away to the government, to the CDC, and say this batch of vaccines seemed to produce a fever in these children. And so we're constantly looking at that sort of thing. We don't know, for example, say adopted children coming from other countries, we don't know, even if they're vaccinated, whether the vaccines they were given were expired, if they were refrigerated properly. So for foreign adoption kids, we often just start all over again because we just have no standards for knowing whether that vaccine was given or whether the vaccine wasn't 3 years old and sitting at room temperature for a month. We just don't know.
We're talking about vaccinating your kids, pediatric vaccinations, on this edition of Midday Matters Health 360. And we want to hear from you. I know there are a lot of questions, sometimes misinformation. We'll try to clear that up. Do give us a call with your questions or comments, 800-471-9264. You can always email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. We need to take a quick break. Back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the creator of the TV series Arrested Development, Mitch Hurwitz. 6 years after this cult hit was canceled by the Fox network, Hurwitz has brought us a new season of 15 episodes on Netflix. People have been binge-watching it all over.
And so, purge-watching it.
And purge-watching it. Join us.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
Award-winning novelist Colin McCann writes to escape.
I don't want to wake up in the morning and roll out of bed and say, I have to spend another 24 hours with that carcass.
So in his new book, McCann inhabits Frederick Douglass and Senator George Mitchell, an Irish housemaid and two intrepid aviators. I'm Ari Shapiro, Transatlantic. Colin McCann joins us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This afternoon at 2 p.m. here on WBOI.
Some great songs by great composers live only on the shelves of the Library of Congress.
You will not hear an incredible torch song for a 1935 MGM flick that never got made.
Lost my one and only.
A trio finds hidden musical treasures and brings them to life later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 here on WBOI.
This week on American Roots, music of travelers and wanderers, migrants and seekers. We'll hear Jack Kerouac on the road and in New Orleans. Plus, we ride the rails with a singer of tales, Ramblin' Jack Elliott. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for Kings of the Road on American Roots from PRX.
Monday night at 7 on WBOI.
It's Midday Matters, Health 360 on WBOI. I'm Sean Beter. Glad to be with you on this Wednesday. We're talking pediatric vaccinations on this edition of our program. And with us this hour to help us out with the topic, Dr. Robert Barnes. He's a pediatrician. We want to hear from you. We know there are a lot of questions and concerns sometimes about vaccinations. And we'd love to hear those questions and your comments as well. Call us at 800-471-9264. You can always email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. We'd love to hear from you this hour. Dr. Barnes, we left off talking a little bit about a lot of parents' concerns in the last few years that the MMR vaccine somehow caused autism, and how that paper has been discredited by an independent panel, and I think even the paper was retracted.
It was an article, a pathologist in England named Dr. Wakefield, and I can't remember the date it came out, but a lot of people in this country became aware of it because it was one of the topics, I believe, on CBS's 60 Minutes show. He felt that the combination MMR vaccine led to the greater risk of autism, and it has been championed by Jenny McCarthy for a while, although I haven't heard a lot of rhetoric from her lately. And I still find in my practice that I have parents who don't want to get that vaccine at the appropriate age. Normally it's 12 months of age. It can be given later. I hear parents say they want to wait till age 2. Dr. Wakefield, I think, even lost a medical license, but I hear rumors that maybe he's still lecturing on this subject. I'm not sure he's changed his opinion of this. At the time he did it, he said that we think it was erroneous, but he said that the MMR combination was the issue. Again, he was practicing in the United Kingdom. At that time in America, we had a choice of giving those three vaccines separately, and I did have some families who chose to do that. Measles was separate from mumps, was separate from rubella, or three-day measles, but that separate preparation, those are no longer available, so now it's MMR. Combination is our only choice. Normally, kids get one around 12 months, and normally in Indiana, they're supposed to be boosted at the kindergarten checkup. The medical research simply doesn't show that it's a causative factor. Now that the human genome is being mapped very well, we feel that a lot of children who have autism do actually have chromosome defects, which means that the problem happened at the time of conception. It had nothing to do with anything in the first 9 months of gestation or afterwards. Mm-hmm. But again, if you look on the internet, if you want to find somebody who's determined to convince other people that the MMR vaccine is dangerous, unfortunately, it's still there on the internet, even though Dr. Wakefield's opinion has been changed. I think Lancet was the British medical journal that appeared in, and all the other contributors to that article retracted all their statements. So I think Dr. Wakefield may be the only one in that group who still purports that this is a serious danger for children receiving the combination vaccine.
Can you explain why parents wanted to wait until after age two? Why they wanted to delay it instead of not have it all together?
I think they feel that the younger child is more vulnerable. And again, I think the combinations of too many vaccines worries them. Generally, by age two, we're pretty much done vaccinating until kindergarten on the routine schedules. Usually, we're done it with an 18-month-old. But I've also found that some parents, I think they may be sort of pulling my leg. Some parents say, we'll do it at age two, and then that time rolls around and the question comes up again. Well, I think we'll wait till next visit. Hmm. But for some reason, that seems to be the excuse they give me. We're going to do it at age two, and then whether they do it or not, I tend to find they still have lingering doubts about its safety.
Are those doubts limited to just MMR, or is it across the vaccination spectrum?
The MMR got cited specifically by Dr. Wakefield again in that erroneous paper in The Lancet, the British Medical Journal. It came out sometime in the 90s. I wish I should have looked up the date. I think the other issue parents worry about is more side effects, again, with the multiple vaccines that are given. We don't have any really new vaccines in the pipeline that I'm aware of, but there have been in the last few years some new combinations that we can give. The kindergartner, there's one company, Glaxo, is making a vaccine that has diphtheria, whooping cough, and tetanus, and polio in it, so it's one vaccine instead of two. But if you happen to be one of those people who worries about the number of vaccines, the combination ones sometimes are not what those parents want. They would like to separate them. As I said, with MMR now, there's no choice. It's MMR or nothing. We do not have these separate ones. So they're not manufactured any longer.
We're talking about vaccinating your kids' pediatric vaccinations on this edition of Midday Matters Health 360. And we want to hear your questions and comments. Call us at 800-471-9264. You can always email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. We'd love to hear from you this hour. We've touched on it a little bit in the first portion of the program, but what are for parents who may be concerned about vaccinating their kids at all or about side effects? I mean, what are the risks of having a significant delay in administering these vaccinations, or maybe not administering them at all?
Sure. To me, the most serious illnesses we need to prevent are tetanus, and this time of year with children playing outside, that's a biggie, and whooping cough for babies, particularly in the winter time. Not vaccinating a child against whooping cough. The babies, it's a 6-week illness. It's kind of 2 weeks coming, 2 weeks the severe phase, the cough, and 2 weeks going away. So it could be 6 weeks of illness, and a lot of babies who are affected are going to spend a few days in the hospital, like it or not, because they really have to be watched 24 hours a day. That's very tough to do. And they often, when they're in the coughing spells, they get choked and turn blue and they need oxygen available. Mm. Luckily, there are very few deaths, but it is a prolonged illness. And I haven't had one for a couple of years, but it is a very scary one. The youngest children are the most affected, the worst affected. And unfortunately, with whooping cough, one dose may not be protective. It's some vaccines, one dose, hepatitis A is a good example. You're immune for maybe 10 years without even the second booster vaccine that still is recommended. Whooping cough isn't quite that good. An infant might be protected. About 75% of the infants are protected with the first vaccine, may go up to around 88% with the second one. But if I can convince families to at least get two doses of pertussis or whooping cough vaccine, in before winter starts in this part of the country, I feel a lot more secure. The worry is just that there still are a lot of these viruses out there. These infections do happen. We may not see them as often as we saw them in the 1950s, but they are still out there. Hepatitis B given in the hospital is recommended because there have been, they're rare, but there have been cases where an infant wasn't immunized, went to maybe a daycare before the 2-month visit and did contract the virus somewhere else. It seems hard to believe, but there are cases of this. So we tend to say, you know, prevention is just so much better than cure, and a lot of these illnesses, we really don't have effective treatments for chickenpox or measles or mumps. Prevention is so much better because I don't have an antibiotic that will affect the course of that disease for a child.
When these vaccines are administered, when there isn't always a 100% protection.
We're absolutely right.
Administered when they get a vaccine.
Right, there is not 100%. Typically, they're way up in the 90s as a rule. But yes, there are vaccine failures. That does happen. As I said, pertussis is probably the most notable one because I just can't tell a parent, I'm sure your child won't contract this illness after one vaccine. Other vaccines, hepatitis A, I mentioned, is much more effective on the first vaccine dose.
We're talking today about pediatric vaccinations, and we want to hear your questions and comments. Call us at 800-471-9264. You can always email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. We'd love to hear from you this hour. We're going to take a quick break for the news. We'll return in 4 minutes. Stay with us. It's Midday Matters.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Parkview Ortho Hospital, offering a wide range of orthopedic treatments to help restore active lifestyles. Parkview Ortho Hospital, together with Ortho Northeast, on the web at ortho.parkview.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Katie Anderson with WBOI News. Governor Mike Pence is encouraging more companies to take part in HIRE, a state program that helps former convicts re-enter the workforce. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports, Pence says the program generated $8 million last year for the state.
Of the more than 20,000 people released from Indiana prisons each year, the Department of Corrections reports 36% return to prison within 3 years. The recidivism rate climbs to 60% if the person is unemployed. The Hoosier Initiative for Reentry or HIRE program was created last year to provide inmates a path to the workforce. Governor Mike Pence says helping people stay out of prison saves the state money.
By working to help citizens reenter society and become reliable workers, if 500 ex-offenders remain employed and out of trouble with the law, that actually would save Hoosier some $4 million a year.
About 200 Indiana employers have hired more than 600 ex-cons since the program began last April. Department of Workforce Development Commissioner Scott Sanders says his agency, along with the Department of Corrections, provides education and training to inmates to prepare them for the workforce. He also says his department works with employers to assure them that the ex-offenders they hire have been strenuously screened.
There is no gang affiliation with any of these individuals that come through the program. No disciplinary action. They pretty much have to have a clean slate in prison for about 2 years. They also have to have an ability to have a job and hold a job while in prison.
Sanders notes there's a federal tax credit for companies who hire ex-offenders, providing greater incentive to companies to take part in the program. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
Indiana farmers have largely made up from the slow start to planting caused by this year's soggy spring, with some saying their fields are now in great shape. The state's farmers are ahead of the 5-year average in getting corn and soybean crops planted. That's a turnaround after being way behind a month ago. The federal government's weekly crop report says that as of Sunday, farmers had planted 94% of Indiana's corn crop and 76% of their soybean fields. The Fort Wayne Comets made the long-awaited announcement yesterday of their new head coach, and it is a familiar name. WBOI's Doug Gruber has the story.
Fort Wayne native and former Comets assistant coach Gary Graham will become the hockey team's 28th coach, replacing retired coach Al Sims. The Comets received about 20 applications for the head coaching job, interviewed 6 candidates before selecting the hometown boy. Graham is a graduate of Northside High School, where he played hockey, and he later coached there, also coached the Snyder club team. Graham spent 4 seasons as an assistant coach with the Comets, sometimes paid, sometimes not. Last season, as coach of the Pensacola Ice Flyers, he took the team to the Southern Professional Hockey League title. Now Graham and general manager David Franke will start to put together a team for their second year in the ECHL. For WBOI News, I'm Doug Gruber.
And the Fort Wayne Children's Zoo has a new addition. The zoo's 3-year-old female red panda, Zhao, has given birth to a cub, and zoo officials are carefully monitoring its progress. Zoo officials who announced the birth Tuesday said the next few weeks are critical to the cub's survival. Zhao gave birth to 2 cubs in 2012, but neither survived. About half of all red panda cubs born in captivity die within 30 days of their birth. More sunny skies are ahead this afternoon. We'll see a high of 77 today. This evening, there is a 30% chance of showers after 2 a.m. Otherwise, cloudy skies with a low of 58. You're listening to Midday Matters on 89.1 WBOI and online at nipr.fm.
Twenty minutes before the top of the hour, 1 o'clock, it's Midday Matters Health 360 on WBOI. I'm Sean Beter, along with Dr. Robert Barnes, and we're talking about pediatric vaccinations on this edition of our program. We want to hear from you today. If you have a question or comment, call us at 800-471-9264. You can always email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. We'd love to hear from you this hour. Looks like we have our first caller on the line, so let's go to the phones and see if Dee is with us. Dee, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Hello. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we have you just
okay.
Fine. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm calling about the vaccination because we have a long history on both sides here. I do genealogy, and so I've read letters from the past, and my great-grandmother described her brother dying of whooping cough, you know, 100 years ago, and it was just so horrible that very descriptive and everything. So we did the vaccinations. We took it hook, line, and sinker, and everything was fine. And then with my second child, and we did a 2-month form at 6 months. At the 18-month vaccine, he had a severe reaction. And after that, he had been, I would say, stronger and so on than his sibling. But after that, he couldn't hold things. He just dropped stuff all the time. He was fussier. And he never did get over that. He's 30 now. And when he reaches for things, he still has the shake that developed when he was 18 months old. And wow. I had to explain it to teachers and everything. So when it came time for his boosters after that, the doctor said, well, he's had, you know, at that time 4 already, so we'll just let it go. Then when he had the MMR in first grade, every time he'd go out for the T-ball, he'd develop a fever and have to rest for a couple days. Then it took him all summer to get over that. So when he went to Purdue, they said, well, you know, you can have a waiver, but you just have to leave school if there's any outbreaks.
Wow.
And now he's married. They're considering children and asked me about it. And I said, you know, I can't make that call. I really can't. But have you ever heard of this kind of thing? And is there a tendency for that to run in families? For example, my mother-in-law said, oh, you know, my boys had a reaction to that. And I'm like, why didn't you tell me?
Wow.
You know, and so I just wondered if you've ever heard of something like that.
Dee, let's put that to Dr. Barnes. It sounds like a bad reaction, and certainly a troubling result. What's your take?
It's very unusual. The tremor after a vaccine of any kind, I'm not aware of that. And typically the reactions usually are things like crying for 3 hours straight, a fever lasting
two or
3 days. It's usually the MMR reaction can be a rash that can show up a week or 10 days later. But typically I think you're talking about the DTaP at 18 months of age, of course, in the MMR at age
that
6.
That was the severe one, yeah.
Right. And your son, any idea what, did he get these shots in the 80s, 90s? The DTaP changed
it
somewhat in the 80s.
Yeah, he's about 30, so it was probably 86 or 7.
There were two DTAPs available then. The old one was called a whole cell, and it had a lot. It had a lot more problems. I remember with high fevers. The tremor part surprises me, or the fever that being outside, you know, in a warm environment would produce a fever after MMR. Those are really unusual ones. I don't know whether your son got the whole cell vaccine or the one we're using now is called acellular DTP. The A is for the acellular part, which has fewer side effects, but we're also starting to learn that maybe its immunity isn't as long-lasting as the original vaccine. But these are not vaccine side effects that are listed as the common ones that the feds, that the CDC or the American Academy of Peds are looking at. They are very interesting. I certainly wouldn't understand a patient who wanted a waiver because of this going on. But I can't say that there's huge numbers like, yes, this is a common side effect. It is not.
Dr. Barnes, to Dee's other question, are you aware of any family connection in terms of bad reactions to vaccines, things like that?
I don't know of any scientific evidence. I've certainly had parents come in and say, unlike your case, where the first child had a vaccine reaction, and therefore they're reluctant or they want to modify what the next child or subsequent children receive. But I, when you look at side effects listed for these vaccines, I'm not aware of any information that says there are some families that have problems with this. It's not part of the routine.
It was the second child that was
right.
Not.
Yeah. It's very interesting. Yeah.
So
I don't know in the warnings that we read, I don't know that there's any familial tendency for issues. There's a familial one with patients who have general anesthetic with high fevers. That one is quite well known, and anesthesiologists need to be aware of that. I'm not aware of anything with childhood vaccines where some families react worse than others. I don't know of a familial tendency that's been identified in the past.
And if they did have a bad reaction like that, is there something you can do now?
It's all
a couple hours that something's going on.
I just make sure that when the patients leave, that if fever is the issue, that we always try to make them understand the appropriate dose of antipyretics for fever, which would be typically acetaminophen or ibuprofen. That's important because the labels on these childhood fever vaccines usually start at age 2 years.
Yeah.
And it is really important that if a parent's aware of a fever, I want to make sure they have a thermometer. I want to make sure that if there's real risk, a lot of times I give them my cell phone number. If there is a real risk, the previous one was strange. But I can't. Once a vaccine's given, I can't undo anything. I can't give you a shot of steroid or send you in for a treatment. Yeah,
yeah.
I don't know of any treatment afterwards. But obviously, it's going to make your anecdotal case is going to make you very skeptical about future vaccines for that child, of course.
Yeah. Well, it's the next generation now, and
I
don't want to meddle, but.
Right.
If I could find out something helpful, it'd be nice.
I think that should be brought up to the doctor at the time of those visits, or even before that, when those vaccines are going to be given. And I just want to make sure that the family's aware that they can call the physician, that there's someone available, and that their appropriate dose of Tylenol or ibuprofen is the right dose for that child to produce the maximum effect. Bring the fever down will often minimize the child's symptoms and help his outlook too if he's one of those who's crying excessively afterwards.
Right.
But I don't know a way to undo them, unfortunately. No. These are these anecdotal cases that often show up on the internet, and it's very hard for us to deal with. I've got 100 patients who need this, and this kind of story is heartbreaking, and it is very hard to explain. Yeah. Maybe yours isn't heartbreaking, but it's, you know.
It is. It's you know.
You lay awake at night. Yeah.
Problem for your child.
Right.
They were so young.
Right. Absolutely.
But like I say, the reading about the ancestor dying of whooping cough, you know.
Well, it's
was
well
the
that,
motivator to get the shot.
Right.
So,
yeah. Well,
so
it's,
I see both sides.
It's luckily it's a rare event now, but in that day the child I'm sure wasn't available to a hospital and
right they didn't have
it wasn't an option. He didn't have access to oxygen.
Probably didn't have antibiotics.
He didn't have anybody. Yeah, he didn't have electric monitors or oximeters to keep track of things. So I'm sure we're doing much better. The death rate's very low, but the natural history of the disease. Yes, I could see how this could happen. Yes.
Well, Dia, we appreciate the call and very good luck.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Bye bye. 800-471-9264 is the number to call if you have a question or comment. Of course, we're talking childhood vaccines on this edition of our program. You can always email us middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet at middaymatters. We have another caller I want to get to in a moment, and do hang on the line with us. But Dr. Barnes, I mean, it seems like there is a possibility for a lot of, case-by-case variants in terms of how some people react to these
absolutely
vaccines.
and
that's a difficult story to hear.
It is, and again, they're anecdotes, and they worry me as well. But as I said, medical research doesn't tend to show large numbers of these problems. And the one she mentioned, an intention tremor or a tendency for fever when the child's overheated outside in a sport. Those are not the listing 15 or 20 side effects that we'll see listed as the common ones we're looking out for. But every visit when a child comes in after the last vaccine, we want to, if more are due at this visit, we do want to go over how did the child respond to the last ones. And sometimes we do modify what we give. But it's not always scientific, I'm afraid.
800-471-9264 is the number to call if you have that question or comment. Let's open the phones once again and go to Ann. Ann, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters. Ann, are you with us?
Hello.
Hi there, Ann. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Okay. I have two questions, somewhat related. Can you hear me?
You're breaking up a little bit. We can hear you.
Yeah, I've had trouble with the phones.
All right. Well, go ahead.
Can you hear
please.
Me?
Yep, we have you just fine. Go ahead.
Okay. First of all, can a person who's never had chicken pox get the shingles?
It would be very unlikely.
Okay.
That's another reason why we like to vaccinate children, thinking that we may be helping them out in the future. Yeah, typically it's a reactivated case of chickenpox many years later when the virus is dormant.
Now, second question, does giving a child the live chickenpox vaccine in itself make the person eligible for developing shingles later on?
We think it's very unlikely, be hard to prove, but we tend to think the chances are much, much less with a child who's vaccinated against chickenpox ever developing shingles. I can't say it's zero. I can't tell you what the number is. It's low, but the chances are very good that a patient vaccinated against chickenpox should not develop shingles at a later age.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And sure. Great question, and thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 10 minutes left in the program. If you have a question or comment about childhood vaccinations, we'd love it if you got in touch. 800-471-9264. Our Facebook page is up. Twitter is up as well, and you can always email middaymatters@nipr.fm. Need to take a quick break. Back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the creator of the TV series Arrested Development, Mitch Hurwitz. 6 years after this cult hit was canceled by the Fox network, Hurwitz has brought us a new season of 15 episodes on Netflix. People have been binge-watching it all over.
And purge-watching it.
Join us.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
Democrat Jim Graves follows Republican Michelle Bachmann out of the Minnesota House race. Missouri's 8th District chooses a member of Congress to replace Joanne Emerson. We remember the late Senator Frank Lautenberg, and Attorney General Eric Holder keeps clashing with congressional Republicans. I'm Ari Shapiro. Neil Conan returns with political junkie Ken Rudin. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This afternoon at 2 p.m. here on WBOI.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Cameron Memorial Community Hospital, providing health and wellness services in the spirit of charity, concern, and excellence, serving Steuben County and surrounding areas. Information at CameronMCH.com.
It's 8 minutes before the top of the hour, 1 o'clock. This is Midday Matters on WBOI Fort Wayne. I'm Sean Beter. With me in studio, Dr. Robert Barnes, pediatrician with St. Joe Medical Group. We're talking about childhood vaccinations on this edition of our program. And if you have a question or comment, do get it in now, 800-471-9264. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm. You can always post on our Facebook wall or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. We hope to hear from you. Dr. Barnes, before we have to say so long, I know you wanted to touch a bit on vaccinations for young people who may be traveling abroad either this summer or beyond.
Right. An awful lot of teenagers and middle school kids, too, go on mission trips. Frequently, they're to rather remote areas. Unpaved roads. There's a very good website that the CDC has, cdc.gov. If you are planning foreign travel, particularly if your child's going to a remote area in Central America, in the Caribbean, or in Africa, typically the diseases, malaria can be prevented with medication given orally, can be daily, can be once a week. Malaria varies throughout the world in what drugs it is susceptible to. So cdc.gov, you can go to the Traveler's Health, click on that, and then you can click on any particular country. It's not quite the same risk if you're on a cruise ship, if your kids are going to London, Paris, and Madrid. Maybe not quite the same risk, but particularly mission trips. And typhoid is the other option, can be given as a shot vaccine or can be given as oral medication. And they each preparation has pros and cons. But again, cdc.gov, Traveler's Health can really help on the specifics. I think most of the travel groups, churches that set up mission trips are very good about making sure that, I don't know what the name of the facility is, but apparently there's someplace in Columbia City that does a lot of this. We hear lots of parents drive, the whole group goes in and gets vaccinated. Somewhere in Columbia City, but that's a place that your doctor can go to, cdc.gov, or you can look at yourself for particulars depending on where that child is traveling. And malaria especially is important because certain areas, chloroquine is they're resistant to. With their child's age, depends on whether they can do tetracycline or not. Doxycycline, I guess, is a preparation. So I do like that website a lot. It's very easy for parents to navigate.
And there are there's a lot of additional information about vaccination schedules, things like that, on the CDC website as well. I want to move to an item in the news that you touched on actually in the very first part of our program here, maybe on folks' minds right now. This weekend we heard about a new hepatitis A outbreak at the 800 Degrees Three Fires restaurant. Dr. Deb McMahon was advising folks who may have dined there in the last few days before to get a vaccination. They ran out. I hear they have more now. Tell us a little bit about how worried folks should be about this outbreak, or about not outbreak, but about this.
Sure,
this
but exposure, the possible exposure. Yeah. It used to be called. It's also known as infectious hepatitis, hepatitis A. It's a virus. Unfortunately, a lot of patients who develop hepatitis A don't have any symptoms. Sometimes it's found later in blood tests that you might have had it. Mm-hmm. The vaccine I mentioned a while ago is works very quickly. One dose can be very effective, although normally it's two doses of hepatitis A vaccine given 6 to 12 months apart. The youngest people who can get it are one-year-olds. It's not given to newborns, but it can be given to children, teenagers, adults of any age. And the protection does happen very quickly. It's a danger in food service because it's, pardon the expression, but it's fecal to oral. It may be prevented by, the passage of it may be prevented by good hand washing, but that can be lacking. Apparently a food handler was identified at that restaurant. And I remember 10 or 12 years ago, there was another pizza chain that I think had hurt their business for quite a while because it turned out, a waitress was found to be hepatitis A positive. It's been a very common virus in the past. Maybe in the last few decades, 30-40% of Americans have evidence in the bloodstream, serologic evidence, that they've had hepatitis A at some point. But most patients don't become terribly jaundiced. They don't feel particularly bad. Maybe they get flu-like symptoms for a few days and figure it was some nonspecific virus. Nowadays, as I said, I think it's going to be required in a year in Indiana for kindergartners. The vaccine is, we've been recommending it for a long time, but it wasn't one of those that the last governor signed into law with all the other ones that he signed a few years back. Generally the vaccine is readily available. Obviously there's a run on it with the Board of Health, and they did run out sometime on Sunday in the afternoon. I read that. But it is very effective, and hepatitis A isn't the worst thing you can get, but like all the other childhood vaccines, we'd like to prevent it if we could.
Certainly not pleasant if you're
affected, right?
Yeah. We have just about 90 seconds here to wrap up. I guess your final advice for new parents or for parents just getting ready to jump in here.
I tend to recommend that the parents say yes to the possibility of a hepatitis B vaccine given to their newborns. There was a controversy about this one. I still hear this sometimes. In the late 90s, there was a worry about the preservative in that vaccine called thimerosal, which has mercury in it. There was concern for a few years about that mercury dose in a small baby weighing 3 kilos versus giving it to a 30, 40, 50-pound child. That one's pretty much, I think the dangers we think now were overstated, but basically I think the only vaccine we have with thimerosal, you cannot avoid it, is the flu vaccine, which is optional. The kill vaccine, which is a shot, still has mercury in it, and that topic still comes up sometimes with parents in my office. Otherwise, they found ways to keep preservatives in the other vaccines without mercury. For me, again, summertime, tetanus is very important to be immunized against, and as we get into fall for the infants, I think whooping cough's the most important ones. Measles, mumps, chickenpox, I'd like to vaccinate against them, hepatitis A, but if I have to state my druthers, if a parent's reluctant to give everything, those are the ones I sleep better at night knowing my kids are immunized against those two illnesses.
All right. Well, we are out of time, unfortunately, for this edition of Midday Matters. Pediatrician Dr. Robert Barnes, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to all of you for listening, for your great questions as well. I'm Sean Beter, and this is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 FM HD Channel 1 and online at nipr.fm. This is WBOI Fort Wayne and WBKE North Manchester, a service of Manchester University. Fresh Air is up next. It's 1 o'clock. Have a great day. From W.